Well, good morning, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Elliot Callan, President, CEO of Prosperity Financial Group, and I want to welcome you to another episode of Meet the Expert. Today, we are speaking with Lara Rimes. Lara is the chief, I wanted to get your title correct. She's Managing Director and Chief Economist for FS Investments. They are an institutional boutique financial firm from the East Coast, managing about $24 billion. We use the firm FS as a strategic partner for some of the investments that they bring to market. So Lara, let me welcome you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great. So Lara, you're an economist, and I like your title. You call yourself the economist that you actually want to hear from. let me say, you have a personality that's good. We've got three main topics we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the economy, we're talking about policy, and we'll talk about how this is going to affect the financial markets. Can we do that?
Perfect.
And I know you'll make it interesting because you look like you're a lot of fun for an economist.
Yeah. I mean, that's step one. Step two is making it relevant. I'm ready to dive in.
I have a dual major in economics, so I'm an amateur economics, and my son is getting a PhD in economics as well right now.
Well, thank God he's not interviewing me.
No, he's a lot drier than I am, so... And hopefully in time, his personality just blossoms and it becomes you. How's that?
Sounds good.
So why don't we start a little bit, Lara? Why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on in the economy in general?
Well, so I sort of think where we are right now, the best analogy I can come up with is taxiing before takeoff. Like, everybody's ready. They see the runway. And what they expect is this rapid, strong acceleration to some, you know, really to some liftoff that really can carry us quite a ways. But right now we're sort of in this holding pattern. There are huge expectations for growth. But right now we've had some more mixed messages. Clearly the pandemic was not helpful at the end of the year. We saw a lot of labor. We saw a lot of job losses related to leisure and hospitality. Consumer and household confidence is held up. That's great. But, the actual activity that we're seeing right now is still kind of more, I would say, in a holding pattern than really at the robust liftoff that we expect later in the year.
Okay. So we all hear about the second half of the year should be a bang up year. A lot of things were put in place for that to happen, some pent up aggression, so to speak, for the economy here. But we may not be out of this mess for quite some time when it comes to COVID. So couldn't that put a lid on what we're talking about?
Absolutely. I think, there's been concern about the variants that we're seeing, how effective vaccines are actually going to be. I think more and more we're all realizing that just because we get the vaccine doesn't mean that we can, throw away all of our burn all of our masks and just go back to the good old days. We may still experience some lingering effects of this. We may still have changes that have occurred in our economy really change the way that we conduct and do business and interact with each other. Travel, I think, is a great example. It's really not clear if international travel is going to come back right away by the end of 2021. That could take years. Conferences. I'm sure you and I would be, enjoying this in person if it were pre-COVID. And now, we're having to do so much separately. I think it remains to be seen how much of that all comes back. So it could be a multi-year process to get things like flying, vacations, tourism, conferences, whole swap concerts, sporting events. Huge parts of our economy and our lives may be altered for quite some time longer.
Well, I work in a building that is more than 50% empty. It's a four-story Class A office building here in San Ramon, California, suburban area of Oakland. We're 50% empty. There are for rent signs everywhere. Yeah. And I know commercial rents are coming down. More and more people are working out of their house. There are some changes that may be permanent here.
Yeah. I mean, especially cities like San Francisco, cities like New York have clearly been among the hardest hit because, jobs that paid a lot, but the cost of living was very high, with work from home has really turned all of that on its head. You know, work from home was something that I know a lot of women colleagues that I have had really fought for. I actually don't care to work from home because all I see is my kids' laundry and toys everywhere. And I just want to run screaming back to the office. So I was like one of the, in the minority, I think, who never really wanted to push for working from home. But a lot of, I think a lot of my colleagues are saying that they don't ever expect to go back to the office 5 days a week. It means that we can totally relocate to, you know, somewhere that's an hour and a half outside of Philly instead of, you know, paying a lot for the near suburbs, for example. So I think we're just at the beginning of these multi-year changes that we're going to see. And I think increasingly it's sort of descend, the reality is descending upon everybody that we are not going to just flip a switch and go back to where things were. And just because you get a vaccine doesn't mean everything just goes completely back to normal.
Well, the same note, I want to talk as this, the transcending environment of working at home is all around us. It's going to have a negative impact on the prices of commercial real estate, which may have an impact somewhere down the line on residential real estate, certainly on commercial loans, commercial lending, and pressure on banks to start sucking it up and forgiving commercial mortgages. This is happening. And not to mention that in state policies, we'll get to federal in a moment, but state policies have been horrible from the political side for riots in downtown New York and downtown Chicago and San Francisco. And I know now that companies are fearing, why are we going to put any money in our office? Let's get out of here.
I think what you've seen, and you know, when you talk to our you know, real estate investment managers, they feel very strongly that there's still opportunity in real estate, in commercial real estate. But to your point, it's completely shifted. You know, office buildings in the suburbs are doing well, specifically because people are moving out of the city and they're happy to put in an office, you know, further away. More people want to live out there. And, you know, you're getting this real sense that there are now a much wider range of risks. It's not just the annoyance of traffic to commute into a large commercial center. There are really a wide range of risks now that make those buildings much less, you know, workable in this setting. I mean, I lived in New York for 15 years working on Wall Street there, and I just can't believe what's happened. I mean, Midtown is a ghost town. So certainly I think you're right. I mean, you know, policies, liquidity, higher share prices, all of these things have really allowed a lot of businesses to sort of, you know, with duct tape, sort of piece it together. But we're still only a year into this. I mean, these are huge buildings. And when leases are up, whether or not people renew, I mean, you're going to see that for years, that issue coming up and wanting to, that whole paradigm shifting. So I agree with you completely. I mean, I think especially given, you know, some of the political, we had riots here too in Philly, you know, it's really disconcerting.
So at the same time, are Philly, New York, San Francisco, are these cities, Chicago, Nashville, whatever, are they on the same collision course that now Minneapolis is on, where Minneapolis is virtually an untenable city to do business in any longer because of all the riots? In New York, San Francisco, it's San Francisco where we live, there are homeless people abounding. I don't want to knock anybody who's homeless. I feel sorry for them and bad for them, and policy's terrible. But it's, they're around us, and it's a dirty, ugly city. New York is dirty and ugly, and I know there's a mayoral race coming on, and the moment I think there are 20 people running for mayor early on. It's, Philadelphia has a reputation of being a very corrupt union city. The election really pointed that out or exacerbated the problem that's already there. These are cities that are not forward thinking in a way that they should be. Are they on a collision path, especially now with taxation? Even California. Let's get out of California. Let's get out of New York. Let's get out of the Northeast. Let's get out of Illinois. How is this going to impact the local economies?
Yeah. So I think you bring up a really good point, Elliot. And this is something that I'm seeing just across the economy, across so many different areas that where macroeconomics sort of collides with finance. And so many trends that we expected to continue, but more slowly, just got compressed into this really, you know, short period of time. So one of them is the fact that a lot of these cities just have really difficult budget situations. And they've really struggled, and states, and they've really struggled with that. And now with COVID, you've had so much movement out of the high tax states that were, of course, charging those taxes because they're trying to fill their budget gaps. And then you have, so I think that's been a huge impact in California. I know that in Philadelphia, for example, there's a wage tax here that a lot of people are like, great, well, now I can just move out of Philly and work remotely and I save myself 3% of my income per year. So there is, I think all of these pressure points just got pushed right over with COVID. I think you're, to some extent though, it's also a very local story, place to place. One observation is that Philadelphia, the rents have not fallen significantly during this pandemic. Part of that is because people relocated from New York down to Philly. You know, it's an hour and 20 minute drive. It's an hour and 15 minutes on the train. The cost of living is so much lower and they could buy, you know, a single family home for $400,000 versus, you know, buying a shoebox for $400,000 in New York. So, and Philly, I think the other thing about Philly, and this is also probably to, you know, relates to your point about city policy, but we have a smaller supply of high quality housing. So we haven't seen, you know, lots of properties go vacant. You know, those properties, if they turn over, they're still actually there's pretty solid demand for them. So all that's to say, you do get localized stories as you move around the country and look at some of the big changes that have happened in cities. I'll say this, if you look at I was looking at doing research on this for another talk that I was giving, and about 10 of the largest cities, 10 of the top 20 cities in the country have experienced significant drops in rent. And that includes, you know, Miami and center, like downtown Dallas and Chicago, San Francisco, New York, the list that you would expect, all that's to say.
Okay, so let's move forward if we can. And we're talking with Laura Rain. She's managing director and chief economist for FS Investments, their boutique East Coast institutional money manager. And so let's talk about the federal government for a moment. And hopefully everybody's still staying with us. Laura calls herself the economist you really want to talk to. So, you know, I have my cup of coffee here because I'm talking to an economist, but I tell everybody, if you're going to spend an hour or half an hour with me, and this is only going to be 20 or so minutes long, you need at least one cup of coffee.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about the federal government now, because the federal government has for the last 14 months been pouring huge amounts of money into the economy. For the first time, the total debt of the United States government in any one year surpassed the gross domestic product, the GDP, which is staggering. We are going to have, under the Biden administration, we will easily pass $35 trillion of total debt by the time he leaves office. Again, a staggering number. Somewhere, somebody's got to pay the piper. Somewhere there's too much money. Somewhere the money's going to become valueless. You know, we've all read these stories about the mark, the marks of Germany in the 1930s and wheelbarrows to go buy your milk. And I'm just worried about, you know, what's going on with the federal government. And I'm looking at Bitcoin at $50,000 per coin is up and coming. What does that do to the federal sovereign reserve? Nope, the U.S. dollar. So I've asked a bunch of questions. Let's talk about the federal government. Tell me what your thoughts about what I just said.
So, you know, there's no doubt. And this also even predates Biden. You know, before the pandemic, we had a really significant rise in deficit spending. Then we had the pandemic. You know, we got another like close to $4 trillion. It's just staggering. We passed 100% of GDP in U.S. government debt outstanding. And then we like shot instantly to 125% of GDP in debt outstanding. It's just been an extraordinary increase. So can that pace of increase be sustained? No. I don't know. You know, it's just not feasible. And hopefully it won't be necessary if we just can get the economy back to a place of more normal, stable growth. We won't need to. And in fact, it doesn't behoove us to just helicopter money mail. I understand why politicians like the sending the checks to people through their mail slot, because it's popular and it's clear and everybody understands it, but we need to solve the infrastructure problem. This has been three administrations now, and it speaks to just the intransigence of the system in Washington that we can't get real meaningful infrastructure investment passed. I mean, that is just a no-brainer and it's badly needed. From the deficit side, no sign that it will fall anytime soon. Who's going to pay for it? Happily, right now, interest rates are incredibly low, even though they've risen a little bit. They're historically low. So, you know, if you're going to take the time to take advantage of low rates and issue debt, this is the time to do it. You have the Fed buying huge amounts of government debt. So that's really, you know, like basically giving the government the open door to just continue to spend because the Fed's absorbing it all. As far as inflation or sort of hyperinflation goes, that is not a big concern of mine. You've seen other countries experiencing what we're experiencing, including Japan, where debt is much higher percentage of GDP. The government deficit's much higher. The central bank owns it all. You just haven't seen inflation there. In fact, it's the opposite. They're still struggling with disinflation. So I think the bigger concern to me by far and away is that 5 years from now, many of the baby boomers will be spending their savings. They won't have this demand for safe assets. They'll be selling it all off. Interest rates will naturally rise more than we've seen in some time. And the government's going to have to crowd out every other kind of spending because they need to service the debt. That to me is by far and away the larger risk. That, you know, that includes defense. That includes, you know, basic services for the country, that they're going to just find themselves unable to spend on anything else except for servicing the debt. So that's a pretty tough situation for GDP and, you know, limits us 10 years from now in a future recession. So it's not good, but I think near term we have bigger problems than the federal deficit.
You know, what's interesting, Lara, is that I only have one more question on the federal government, and we'll go talk to the really financial markets. But all this deficit we're building up, someone's going to pay for it at some point, probably our children. What happens if, you know, China, which is the most aggressive country on the planet right now, decides that they can be more aggressive and they decide Taiwan belongs to China. And then they decide that all those islands that they built belong, the South China Sea belongs to them and the shipping lanes belong to them. And the U.S. Navy is called up and we're not funding any of that right now. And so we're 125% of GDP in annual deficits. At some point, we're going to be 200%. And we can't answer it sitting here, but unfortunately or sadly, that is looming as a great cloud over us.
I think that when I talk to people and they're really worried about this, the reality is, and households have done this. If you're really worried about the federal deficit, you need to save more because in your retirement, the government may not be able to give you the same benefits, which are paltry already, that they have given our parents. There aren't going to be the safeguards for us in old age. So, you know, you need to save now if you're worried about the government's ability to provide for you in the future, which I know I am. And I think it's something that you've seen from households. The household balance sheet, people have been saving. And if that isn't just the pandemic, the savings rate fell for the last 10 years. We've never seen that in a sustained healthy expansion. You could argue this one wasn't quite as healthy, but I think that's the conversation.
Okay. And last question about federal policy is that because of the election, all elections have consequences. Is that some of the people in power now want to change the taxation structure. And most presidents want to change it somewhat and put their stamp on it. Trump did his, Bush, Clinton, everybody did some tax policy changes. The tax policy pressure now is to raise taxes. People are making too much at the upper end, and we can argue what the upper end is, whether it's $400,000 a year or $250,000 a year or just $150,000 or $100,000 as a married couple. They want to raise taxes. They want to change capital gains No one's talking about changing real estate on the 1031s, which I don't understand those laws. That no one wants to change those, but that's the pressure of the lobbying group in real estate. They're doing one heck of a great job for their constituents. But how does the if taxes do start going up on both a state level and a federal level, that's going to change the savings rate. That's going to change how much Americans have in their pocket to spend. What do you think?
I would guess. And so, you know, again, this isn't my area of expertise. When I talk to our team in Washington, I think their view is very much that a really dramatic rollback of tax cuts is unlikely. I think Biden knows that they were popular. He's going to just, I think, try to be more. His majority in the Senate is so slim. He's got to really pick and choose what he really wants to do with that. And instead of trying to address, you know, income inequality has gotten a lot worse, but instead of trying to address it with, you know, some high, like dramatically higher taxes for large swaths of households, what he's really going to try to do is to, you know, like try to get some movement on the minimum wage, try to get better services, try to spend more for services that help raise the lowest group, the lowest quartile of households, not as much diminish the highest quartile of households. So that's their view. And I think, you know, let's face it, these new administrations, they have like 1.5 years to really do anything. And then they're, you know, stuck in midterms, and that probably won't go that well for Democrats. So, you know, if he wants to get anything done, he's got to do it now. So he's going to have to be selective. Like, he's going to have to pick and choose, just given how slim his majority is.
Okay. Well, let's get personal with our money if we could.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, and we have the phrase that we own here, if it's money, it's personal. And it's true.
I love it.
People do talk about their money. Equities have had, except for last March, April, and May, equities since 2009 have had a really good run. Last year, they had an unbelievable run powered by primarily technology. There's some science in there. Now it appears it's broadening a little bit in the market, but it's still a technology-driven market. It's still Google and Netflix and Amazon and all those names that are powering the economy here. How long can we sustain this?
So much of it, I don't know how long we can sustain it. I think the reason that it's been so strong is the falling interest rate, especially the last year and a half, with interest rates at zero, people have just been pushed so far out on the risk curve that they are all in on equities. I think markets are very much, equity markets have priced to assume that this is just a near-term disruption in earnings, but that by the fourth quarter of this year, we're going to be back to pretty much where we were pre-COVID. That's a pretty positive earnings outlook. So I think two things could happen. I think if long-term interest rates rise much past 2%, you start to get all of those people that figured, like all the rhino people, or all the, like, what is their note? All the Tina people, there is no alternative, who were thinking that, you know, it with long-term interest rates at 0.5, and the S&P 500 kicking off 2% of dividend, like, why not? That's even your fixed income right there. So I think if U.S. interest rates rise to 2 to 2.5, which with our deficit, they may very well do that. You know, you really would get a big sea change of people thinking, suddenly realizing that the volatility in equity markets really isn't worth it when you can just at least get a little something off of with some more stability. I think the other thing that could happen is, you know, as the Fed withdraws or changes their asset purchases. This isn't a 2021 story, but beyond that, you know, let's face it, the Fed has thrown, outside of the government, the Fed has thrown $4 trillion of liquidity at the markets. That's just a staggering number. I mean, we have a phrase that we own that's called, if you squeeze the donut, the jelly's got to go somewhere. You know, like, you end up with people just pushing liquidity into equity markets, into, you know, corporate bond issuance has been staggering last year. I think all that's to say that the Fed is like hypercharged markets, and any sign of that rolling back will also have, I think, an impact. So whether tech is going to be the leader, I mean, I'm very bullish on equities for next year. I think the question is whether you get sort of a violent rotation in leadership. That's to me a really significant question for the coming year.
Well, that's a good question. We do see, I just wrote an article, a blog. We do see 3 10% corrections this year.
Volatility. That would be a rough ride.
It is going to be a rough ride. We're still going to, I believe, we'll end higher than where we started, but it could be painful along the way. I think it's going to be most painful for the conservative investor. The investor that is in bonds, that's 100% in bonds or 80 or 60% in bonds, not looking for volatility. And I'm worried about that because they don't have a lot of places to go. You can't put them in convertible bonds. That's going to have too much volatility. High yield bonds, that always has volatility for them. Their inflation-related bonds, there's not enough inflation for them to make any money.
That's right.
U.S. Treasuries are going to go down in value. Core bonds are going to go down in value. So where does the conservative investor go?
I still think, you know, there is the need and the room in portfolios for that fixed income piece. You just have to be much more tactical. I think we're looking, you know, we've seen a lot of significant inflows back into floating rate products. You know, I think that interest has been really odd. This is, you know, this is a class of assets that as a whole saw pretty significant outflows over the last several years as rates just came down. But now if they're actually coming up again, you know, if we start at the end of this year, beginning next year, the Fed kind of, there's a whiff of discussion of, you know, like raising rates at some point. You know, expectations for rate hikes by the end of 2024 have gone from only, you know, one rate hike to now over 5 rate hikes. That's been a big move in interest rates you've seen. Those futures of Fed rate moves. So you get an environment like this, you know, I think floating rate notes is an important way to, you know, hedge yourself against higher interest rates. And I think it, you know, we've seen those inflows really be significant again. And I think high yield is really interesting. I mean, it's performed well, but if, you know, it's not at the, you know, fifth percentile of historic valuation like equities are. There's still room to go there within high yield. You know, again, this is speaking to your issue about conservative investor versus not conservative investor, but the spread between high quality high yield and lower quality high yield is still very wide, which speaks to me that there's room for that gap to close as, you know, a little bit on the risk frontier. But I think you're at the core question. Conservative investors have been, you know, perhaps overly complacent that equities only go up. And if we get a year like you're describing, which I would strongly agree that there's a strong probability we're not going to get the seamless increase, but we're going to get more turbulence. I think in that situation, the conservative investors are going to fare very badly because, you know, your Barclays Ag isn't doing anything. I mean, you know, there's nowhere to go. There's no, everything's just been pointing towards long duration and that's it. And when that's no longer the play, you need to really shorten your duration risk. You know, you need to go for the real estate fund. You know, you need to go for things that have the floating rate base with a shorter duration.
So last question here, and you've been great. And I really appreciate your time. I don't want to just talk about labor for a moment. I'm going to go backwards to the policy. 60% of our clients are entrepreneurs. They either currently own a company.
So is my husband.
Good. They either currently own a company or they did own a company and they're retired now and they get it. And we all know that outside of the cost of insurance, which is always too expensive, especially in California, that labor rates are the dominant expense to a company. And so there is pressure in California and pressure in New York, or at least pre-COVID pressure, that labor rates were just going up by the day on everything we did, at least for talented labor. I know as an office, we pay more for labor than we've ever paid. Our expenses of labor are higher than they've ever been, and raises are expected more often than they ever were. But across the country, we know that there's a pressure on a minimum wage coming out of the Biden administration, even though he's backed off a little bit as of today. But there's pressure on that minimum wage. If you raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, then every wage corresponding, every union job has to increase what they're making because they're 20% over minimum by contract. So that price goes up. And there's going to be enormous pressure on labor, which squeezes small business owners like myself. And that means profits come down, taxes come down to the federal government. I'm spending less because I'm paying myself less. I'm not hiring as often because I'm going to do more with fewer people. Tell me what your thoughts are on that and the cascading effect on the pressure of wage inflation.
I think what I see as, to me, the real problem with labor is that you've got a small group that's better educated, has technical skills, you know, has office skills, have more service-oriented, sort of high-end service-oriented skills. And then you have an enormous group that does not have those skill sets. We know that just at the broadest level, you know, job openings have declined, that there are still, you know, 9 million people out of work. There's still, from pre-pandemic, there are still, you know, there are another 4 million people who've just dropped out of the workforce, maybe because they have to, you know, attend to kids or to an aging parent that they take it out of a nursing home. All that said, you know, my husband also, when he tries to hire someone, he's like, everywhere I look, people are complaining that they're out of work, and yet I can't find a qualified, you know, person to be an account manager at my company. And I think, to me, this really speaks to the problem with educating, with pulling that education piece to the middle. I think it's really short-sighted. And frankly, I think it's, I think that the idea that we need to get all of these people college educations is just untenable. You know, you have seen company by company really good experiences with, you know, actually providing vocational, not entrepreneurs, but like Boeing, you know, large automakers have created vocational programs that are 1 year long with an apprenticeship, and then you're off and running, that cost a fraction of college and actually give people a good wage, you know, a higher manufacturing wage. So to me, it is a deep structural problem where, you know, you have people like you, people like my husband who are looking to hire, but their pool is actually very small and very restricted. And we need to bring way more people into that pool. We just need to really think of creative ways to expand that, because the system that we have just isn't working. I mean, we see the student loan debt. You know, we see how many people are unemployed and unable to get jobs. The answer is not to just give them $15 an hour minimum wage. The answer is to give them some cheap, useful education that they can take and translate into an hour wage.
Larry, you've been great. We've been talking about Laura Rhine. She's the managing director and chief economist for FS Investments. They're a boutique East Coast firm managing about $24 billion. And it's been a lively discussion. And I think your phrase was an economist you actually want to hear from. And you proved that. So I thank you very much for a great discussion, and FS for helping us out. Lara, thank you.
Thanks, Elliot. This is really fun.
Thank you. And have a great day, everyone. We'll see you soon.